When a person discards property in a public place where he cannot reasonably have any continued expectation of privacy, the property will be deemed abandoned for purposes of search and seizure. The Court of Appeals has now concluded that the defendant abandoned a bag containing $65,000 when he left it at a kiosk in Best Buy and walked to the registers at the front of the store. Hence, there was no violation of the defendant's rights when officers searched the bag without a warrant. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Pardo, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina.
Joe, before we talk about abandoned property, the Court of Appeals also recently said that a prosecutor was permitted to argue that the defendant had committed a rape despite his prior acquittal for that. Tell us about State versus Lamb.
State v. Lamb, Jonathan, this is a case out of Johnston County decided by the Court of Appeals on October 1st, 2025. The facts of the case are pretty grisly. The victim, Kathy Thomas, was last seen on November 23rd and reported missing about a week later. When police interviewed the defendant first told police he had last seen Thomas around November 24th, that they had a consensual sexual encounter and that he drove her home. Defendant later admitted to handcuffing Thomas while they had sex, that he discovered the victim dead in the bathtub and buried the body in his girlfriend's backyard. Subsequent investigation, the police found the body buried in the defendant's girlfriend's backyard. Defendant's DNA was found in the victim's vagina. In defendant's garbage can, police found bleach-stained clothes and gloves, and then later in his home, they found a blood-stained cleaning tool. In early 2019, defendant was indicted for first-degree murder, first-degree rape, first-degree kidnapping, and habitual felon status. The matter came on for trial first in September of 2022. During that trial, the trial court at the close of the state's evidence dismissed the rape and kidnapping charges, and then on the murder charge, the jury hung, and the trial court declared a mistrial. The matter came on for retrial in September 2023. At that time, the state indicated it would proceed under two theories of first-degree murder, one, premeditation and deliberation, and two, felony murder via the rape and the kidnapping. During jury selection and opening statements, the state told the jury, over the defendant's objection, that the defendant raped and murdered the victim. At trial, the state offered evidence of the alleged rape. The trial court refused, however, to instruct the jury on felony murder, as defendant had been acquitted of the rape and the kidnapping in the prior trial. During closing argument, the prosecutor played a video of defendant's interrogation for the jury and asked, looking at the defendant, "Was that a lie or did you just forget it?" Defendant objected to that statement. The trial court sustained the defendant's objection, but then denied the defendant's motion for a mistrial. Defendant was convicted of second-degree murder, habitual felon status, and then defendant appealed. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant raised essentially three issues, one of which the Court of Appeals dealt with summarily. That was the argument that the trial court erred by allowing the prosecution to proceed on this theory of felony murder on the basis of these underlying felonies for which the defendant had already been acquitted. The Court of Appeals, in a footnote, pointed out that the trial court did not instruct the jury on felony murder based on those underlying felonies, so this wasn't really an issue in the case at all. The two arguments that the Court of Appeals addressed were, one, that the trial court erred by allowing the state to argue that he raped and kidnapped the victim, again, because he had been acquitted of those charges in the first trial, and secondly, by denying his motion for a mistrial during closing argument based on that prosecutor's comment, did you forget or was that a lie? Addressing first the rape and kidnapping argument, the rule is, under the doctrine of collateral estoppel, charges must be dismissed when an issue of fact or law essential to a successful prosecution was necessarily determined by a previous acquittal. Collateral estoppel does not apply when the same evidence could be introduced for a different purpose, however, such as illustrating the chain of events, explaining the context, the motive, and the setup. Here, the defendant's judicial acquittal for rape and kidnapping did not collaterally estop the state from introducing evidence that defendant committed the rape and the kidnapping. That's consistent with other cases we've got that say, look, if the jury is not being asked to determine the defendant's guilt of a crime for which he has already been acquitted, there's no problem in allowing the state to introduce evidence of those other crimes, kind of to show the chain of circumstances to tell the full story of the event. As for the prosecutor's comments during jury selection and opening statements and closing arguments, an attorney is permitted to argue all facts and evidence and reasonable inferences to be drawn from that evidence. The Court of Appeals recognized that because that evidence was not improperly admitted here, it was also not improper for the prosecutor to make argument based on that evidence. Here, the state was permitted to argue that the defendant sexually assaulted the victim, and there was no error in allowing that evidence or that argument.
You know, Joe, you mentioned this is consistent with some case law on it, but I think some folks listening to this might be a little bit surprised by that. You had mentioned in the fact summary that it was a motion to dismiss that was granted by the court, right, in the first trial on those charges. But, I mean, the motion to dismiss was granted for insufficient evidence. So, I mean, like you said, he has been acquitted of these things, right? We have a judicial determination that you cannot establish as a matter of fact or law that he did these things. And yet here is the prosecutor in court saying, ladies and gentlemen, I'm arguing to you, he did these things as well as this murder. And yet the court here is saying, because it's for this different purpose, it's just for the context or the, you know, set up the chain of events, that was still allowed despite the earlier dismissal. I think some people might find that a little bit surprising.
Yeah, there's 2 points to make about that. First of all, you're right. It was in the first trial that it ended ultimately in a hung jury. The trial court had granted the defendant's motion to dismiss for insufficient evidence. For double jeopardy purposes, that constitutes an acquittal moving forward. There are some places when that's a little bit negotiable, but in this situation, that's absolutely right. That is a hard stop, which means the defendant can't be prosecuted later for those the rape and the kidnapping for which the trial judge found insufficient evidence. But the second thing is, as you pointed out, that does not necessarily preclude the admission of evidence at a later trial. I've got a blog post on this that I posted a few months back entitled, When is Double Jeopardy a Rule of Evidence? There is some very narrow circumstances when a collateral estoppel argument might preclude the relitigation of a particular fact and keep the state from offering certain evidence at trial. But in this situation, where a defendant has been acquitted of certain charges, but those charges are tied up with other crimes that the defendant is being retried for, merely the fact that he was acquitted of those other charges does not preclude the state from introducing evidence of the whole sort of chain of circumstances to tell the full story of the crime for which he's on trial.
And it's not a true double jeopardy because, like you said, the jury was not instructed on a felony murder based on that, right? We're not asking them to find as a fact that it did happen. I'm just giving you this evidence for what I would argue is the full picture of what did happen and what he's on trial for.
The full picture, the context of the crime for which he's on trial. That's right. And in this case also, like I said, the defendant tried to make an argument that there was some error in allowing the state to pursue this theory of felony murder. Had the trial court allowed that, that would have been a problem because felony murder with an underlying felony of rape or kidnapping necessarily makes those acquitted charges a lesser included offense. The defendant could not be prosecuted for those, again, because he's already been acquitted. But just in terms of allowing the evidence and argument of what else was going on while this murder was being committed, there was no error in allowing that.
So then what about this other issue of the prosecutor essentially posing a question to the defendant almost in closing argument?
Yeah, so the Court of Appeals ultimately finds that it was not error to deny the defendant's motion for a mistrial. The point to make there, though, is the trial court did sustain the defendant's objection. This was not a proper argument for the prosecutor to make, to look directly at the defendant in trial and say, are you lying? That elicited an objection and the trial court sustained that objection. The argument on appeal here was that the defendant was also entitled to this additional relief, not only of sustaining the objection and telling the jury not to consider it, but that the trial court should have allowed a mistrial, should have started the entire process over again based on this comment. The Court of Appeals said, though the state may comment on a defendant's failure to produce witnesses or exculpatory evidence, it may not comment on a defendant's failure to testify. That was really the argument the defendant was making here, was that when the prosecutor pointed it at him and said, was that a lie or did you forget? That was a comment on the defendant's failure to testify. The Court of Appeals rejected that argument, said that that comment could not reasonably be construed as a comment on the defendant's failure to testify. It merely highlighted prior inconsistent statements that the defendant had made to the police. So ultimately, it found there was no error in the trial court's denial of the defendant's motion for a mistrial and upheld the conviction in this case.
And Joe, I'm certainly not encouraging people to approach the line on this, but what I was really struck by in this opinion was in citing some of the authority for that, they mentioned the State versus Miller case from 2003, holding that the state's comment of, quote, still waiting for the defendant to deny the allegations was also not improper. So, I mean, there is some flexibility here. I guess maybe our takeaway from prosecutors would be to try to just, phrase that a little differently, right? I mean, it's not looking at the defendant and saying, so, were you lying then or are you lying now? Maybe we just want to turn back to the jury and say, so the question we have to ask ourselves is, or, you know, it's something to sort of maybe, I don't know, not soften it up, but just change the focus a little bit, just so we're not risking that objection or getting that distraction.
Yeah, we've had a few cases recently about that. It's such a touchy issue about the failure to testify. I mean, better just to steer clear of that altogether. And the point I want to make here is that the trial court sustained the defendant's objection to that statement, and the Court of Appeals was addressing whether the defendant was entitled to this additional relief of a motion for a mistrial. And the Court of Appeals had no problem in saying he was not entitled to that. I think the second case we had on for today was State v. Ramsey. Tell us about Ramsey.
Yes, State v. Ramsey is another case we got on October 1st of this year. This is a case that originally came out of Mecklenburg County. The facts on this involve a lot of different people. I'm not going to try to get into all the nuances of it, but for our purposes, what's relevant here is that the defendant and his wife went to go visit a couple of other people, some family related to his wife, and people at this house were having this ongoing dispute involving her uncle, who they called Juicy, was having a dispute with the nephew, who's ultimately the victim in the case, Billy McKay. They lived at this house together. They had gotten into an argument about something. Another person had made this t-shirt and put it on Facebook talking about the dispute. And so on this date, August 22nd, the defendant and his wife had gone over to the house to try to address that. So they were here to talk to McKay about the t-shirt, and the defendant had also come along to protect his wife while that was going on. At some point after this discussion has happened between all of them and the defendant and his wife have left, the person who made the shirt believed that the defendant had taken the shirt with them, which then leads to this other dispute between the defendant and McKay about getting the shirt back or getting compensation for it, saying that he owed them for the shirt or else they have to give it back. Later that evening, McKay and this person who had allegedly made the shirt return from a trip to the grocery store, and they see that the defendant is standing there in the driveway to the apartment. So the defendant then asks McKay to get into the defendant's car, ostensibly to give him some money to pay him back for this shirt that's now missing about the fight. They're standing in the driveway for a minute, having a discussion back and forth, and then suddenly the state's evidence would be that the defendant strikes McKay in the face and begins beating on him. McKay's girlfriend, Avery, the one who made the shirt, takes their younger daughter back inside. The defendant then follows her inside. She would say, threatening her with a gun and telling her, don't come back out here or I'm going to do the same thing to you. When this ultimately comes to trial, the girlfriend, Avery, testifies that the defendant walked out of the apartment and walked out of the room. She saw McKay then walking into the apartment, sits down in a chair, pulls his phone out. He's apparently trying to call 911 or call for help. She said she could see that he's moving his mouth like he's trying to talk, but there's no sounds coming out. So Avery then calls 911 as McKay, the victim, passes out. He's taken by medics to a hospital and unfortunately dies a short time later. And the defendant is subsequently charged with second-degree murder. That case comes on for trial in October of 2023. And the state presents a lot of evidence, including this testimony from Avery and testimony from various other people, medical examiner, a doctor, some of the responding officers. Some of that testimony from one of the responding officers includes talking about doing a search of the crime scene and finding a cell phone on the driveway. And so that cell phone is collected. And from that cell phone, the state obtained a video, which is then introduced at trial as State's Exhibit 37. It's a 20-second video clip of the fight from the cell phone that was found. That gets admitted for illustrative purposes during Avery's testimony. And the jury asks in deliberations to see the video a number of times. They ask if they can come back and look at it. They end up watching it several times back out in the room, I think at least three additional times after the first time they'd asked to see it again. So they're certainly considering it as they are engaged in their deliberations. Another issue that had come up is that at the close of the evidence and the arguments, the jury began their deliberation and they were only instructed on second-degree murder and voluntary manslaughter. The defendant was asking for an instruction on the lesser charge of assault, which the court did not give. So ultimately, the trial court denied that motion. Jury did not receive that lesser instruction, and the defendant was found guilty of the lesser charge of voluntary manslaughter. So there's two issues with this that are being discussed on appeal, and the first of those has to do with this video clip that was admitted, again, for illustrative purposes. The defendant is arguing that there was no foundation for this, right? This is just a cell phone that's found in the driveway. What camera was used? You know, in all those state versus canon factors that we sometimes get into when we're talking about admitting evidence for not illustrative, but but rather substantive purposes. You know, then under State v. Cannon and all those cases interpreting it, along with 8-97, you know, we need to know that the camera was working properly. It made an accurate recording of it. This is the same video that's being introduced here at trial. And actually, Joe, it's kind of noteworthy. The state went to some lengths to sort of lay a foundation, evidently, for this video. You know, with the officer, the detective who testified, it talked about he was he's an expert in digital forensics and analyzed the contents of the phone. And they're talking about how this phone was placed into the property room. You know, it was sealed up in a bag, and here it is still in court. All this sort of background for it, I guess, trying to lay what would be a foundation to get it authenticated and admitted. But again, what we're talking about here is it was offered for illustrative purposes. Remember, Avery is talking about, I saw this fight happening in the driveway, and yes, this video fairly and accurately illustrates my testimony for the jury. And so that ultimately is how the court resolves this, that the state laid a proper foundation for the video as illustrative purposes by presenting the testimony from Avery that the video fairly and accurately illustrated the fight as she saw it. You know, this is something, Joe, you and I went through this recently at the new prosecutor school. This is something that we talk about a lot, that there are these very different and lesser standards if we just want to offer it for illustrative purposes. And I guess the point I wanted to make here is for prosecutors, if we are in trial, if as sort of a matter of trial strategy or jury presentation, you know, if we want to offer this additional testimony to reinforce to the jury that we're taking this seriously, we think this evidence is important. I'm not saying there's anything wrong, you know, with having that sponsoring witness like your detective or your officer talk about how it was collected and how it's been preserved and nothing has been changed. You know, if we want to do that to reassure the jury, we absolutely can. But I think it's important to remember and to stress to the judge, if there maybe seems to be a little bit of confusion about that, that those higher standards are for substantive purposes. A surveillance video that nobody else can speak to. The camera has to kind of speak for itself. But that's not what we were dealing with here. So it was correctly admitted as illustrative evidence, and the minimal foundation required for that, the testimony from Avery, was sufficient. The second issue that came up...
So let me pause you right there. So basically, it didn't matter whose camera this was or where the phone was found. I mean, so long as we've got a witness to testify, I observed this fight, and the video that you're presenting accurately depicts the altercation... Where the video came from or whether they've established a chain of custody for the camera is irrelevant.
Couldn't matter less. I mean, it wouldn't matter if we put prompts into some ChatGPT or Sora or whatever, you know, just made an AI video depicting what we're talking about. And then we're just offering it as an illustrative aid. So, yeah, it just does not matter whose camera this is. What do we know about it?
We just have to have a witness to say that accurately and fairly reflects my recollection of what I observed.
Exactly, because the witness's testimony is the evidence that we're offering. And then this is just an illustrative aid to assist in the presentation of that testimony. I think defense attorneys probably are, if any of them are listening to this podcast, probably roll their eyes at that. And they would point to the fact that this jury wanted to come back. They didn't ask to have Avery's testimony read back to them. They asked to watch this video again three or four times in the jury deliberations. And so, yes, I mean, we all know video is powerful. I think the jury is going to pay a lot of attention to it. But I mean, as a rule of evidence, if what we're doing with it is just illustrating testimony, then that's the only foundation that we need, is that it fairly and accurately illustrates the testimony that we're talking about. The other final thing I'll say, we always try to stress when we're talking to prosecutors, is just bear in mind, if you're only offering it as illustrative evidence, that's all it's admitted for. You know, so when we are coming back and talking about, for example, responding to the defendant's motion to dismiss for insufficient evidence, that video is not standing on its own as substantive evidence of something that's depicted in the video. You know, I mean, if there's a critical point about whether a person did or didn't have a weapon in their hand, you know, the video shows that, but the witness's testimony does not. Well, that was just illustrating their testimony, right? You know, so we would need something like the testimony to establish those substantive facts. So you can definitely offer it for the illustrative purposes with less foundation, but just remember that's all you've admitted it for if you get there. The second issue briefly was this question about the jury instructions, that the defendant is arguing here that, yes, I know we have precedent that says if I've been indicted by a short form indictment, simple assault is not a lesser included of that, right? Because there's other ways a person may commit a murder. The short form indictment is alleging all those, but binding case law, State v. Collins, State v. Whiteside, says that the lesser included assault instruction is not encompassed by the short form murder indictment. The defendant is arguing, but wait, We recently had State versus Singleton. You know, Singleton was the one that said, even if there was one or two things missing from the indictment, that's not deemed a jurisdictional defect that you could be arguing on appeal later, as long as the defendant was essentially on notice, that's going to be sufficient. And Joe, this is something you and I have talked about a number of times, is what is the outer limit of the impact of Singleton? You know, I mean, is this sort of a signal that we're stepping away in a broader sense from the significance of what's actually contained in the indictment? You know, hey, you were put on notice of murder or whatever the charge may be. Can we just take that as, I think in the defendant's words, this is just sort of the technical way that it was indicted. The defendant should not have been denied a proper jury instruction on a lesser included offense because of the technical style of the indictment that the state chose to use. In other words, doesn't Singleton just kind of throw all these rules out the window? And so shouldn't we be allowed to get the lesser included that could have been a lesser included had it been indicted a different way or had additional things been included in the indictment? Court of Appeals here says, no, that is not what we're talking about with Singleton. They say that Singleton was limited to that issue, that the way we characterize it, you know, that we're saying just failing to include something, even an element, is not necessarily depriving the court of jurisdiction to hear the case as long as the defendant was properly put on notice about what it is. They say Singleton did not, however, discuss or create any holdings regarding lesser included offenses within short form indictments. Rather, Singleton specified only what elements a short form indictment requires. Joe, the context you and I have talked about this more often is, what is the significance perhaps of Singleton for something like, can I make a motion to amend? Does it broaden the scope of what could be amended in an indictment because it signals this sort of being less strict in general about indictments? And I mean, that's not what the issue was in this case, but I look at this case as sort of an indicator of saying, maybe not. You know, I mean, there may be all those old rules about when you can or what is or is not a substantial alteration that could or couldn't be made by an amendment. I think for now, we want to assume that those rules still apply. You know, if we think this is an outside the line amendment, let's just do a superseding indictment. Let's not assume that Singleton really changes that. I think Singleton, it stands for what it stands for, but we're not going to start importing it to these other contexts where those were not really the issues that were being addressed in.
Well, the other thing that I think it illustrates, right? I mean, I've written about Singleton a few times, and it's one of those opinions that on its face looks like a very state-friendly rule. The ultimate holding of Singleton being, if you leave out an element, so long as the defendant had adequate notice of what he was charged with, that mere omission of a single element of an offense is not going to deprive the trial court of jurisdiction. The state can proceed so long as the defendant doesn't raise that issue in apt time. But what this case illustrates also is when you move away from those technical requirements for indictments, that in some cases is going to be as much of a benefit for, potentially could be a benefit to a defendant as much as it is to the state. Because you've got this situation where the parties are litigating about what instructions are supported by the indictment. If there is no longer this strict limitation on what can be charged based on the elements in an indictment, it kind of is up in the air of what conviction will be supported by this indictment when it's no longer a jurisdictional question. All of that is to say, I think Singleton does represent a major change, and we're still kind of working out the consequences of that.
Absolutely.
But I come back to the conclusion that you did, which is until we have more direction from the North Carolina Supreme Court, I see the Court of Appeals as reluctant to expand Singleton into these other areas that it doesn't seem to touch, that we're going to continue to maintain the rules as we understand them. A short-form murder indictment will not support a conviction for assault. So even if the defendant is asking for that instruction, it's not error not to give it.
And you know, Joe, maybe I would also add, especially in a circumstance like this, where we have very clear case precedent saying, no, simple assault is not lesser included under short-form murder. And, you know, I mean, it would be an even bigger leap, I think, for the Court of Appeals to say, we're going to read Singleton as sort of an implied overruling of multiple cases of clear precedent we have on this exact question. They certainly weren't willing to go that far.
Right.
And so then, Joe, I think the last one we had on was the one you flagged in the introduction, the State versus Pardo case.
Yeah, this is an interesting case primarily because of the facts and sort of the... I guess what I would call potentially a surprising outcome. State v. Pardo is a case from Carteret County decided by the Court of Appeals in October 1st of 2025. The facts of the case arose out of a situation back in 2021. On July 10th, there was a theft from a Best Buy in Moorhead City. And then a few days later, on July 13th, defendant and a woman named Lawrence went to the Best Buy, and a loss prevention officer saw them, recognized them as the suspects from the prior larceny, and reported to the police that the people that had stolen something a few days ago had come back. Unbeknownst to the defendant and Lawrence, this report is going on. Defendant goes to a kiosk that's located, the Court of Appeals says, around the middle of the Best Buy to buy a cell phone. Around 7 p.m., defendant and Lawrence are standing there at the kiosk. They observe two Morehead City police officers enter the store. At that point, Lawrence walks away from the kiosk. She says later it's because she's taking a firearm that the defendant had back to their vehicle outside of the store. Defendant hands the sales associate $1,300 in cash to pay for his phone. He sees at this point that the officers detained Lawrence at the door of the Best Buy. Before this transaction with the sales associate is finished, defendant abruptly walks away from the kiosk, leaving behind his bag, a black bag that he had brought, on the customer chair at the kiosk in the middle of the Best Buy. Another officer detained defendant close to the door there. Defendant and Lawrence denied stealing the items on July 10th, even after they were shown the surveillance video of these two people stealing items from the Best Buy. Police then discovered a handgun in Lawrence's purse. Police told defendant he would be allowed to leave the store after paying for the stolen items and the phone that he was then buying. Defendant agreed to that condition. He walked to the front registers, pays for the items that were stolen on July 10th and for his cell phone. While all of that is going on, a manager of the Best Buy handed to one of the police officers the bag that the defendant left at the cell phone kiosk. Officer Clark told defendant that she wanted to search the bag. Defendant's eyes apparently got really big, and he looks at Lawrence. Lawrence whispers something in the defendant's ear. Officer Clark then asks the defendant if there's anything in the bag that might stab her or poke her. Defendant says no. Officer Clark searches the bag, and inside the bag, she finds narcotics and about $65,000 in cash. Defendant admitted the bag was his. The police at that point arrested both the defendant and Lawrence. In March of 2023, defendant was indicted for two counts of trafficking methamphetamine, one count of possession with intent to manufacture, sell, or deliver marijuana, one count of manufacturing marijuana. Defendant files a motion to suppress the evidence obtained from that search of his bag. The motion to suppress came on for hearing in April of 2024. The trial court ultimately denies the motion to suppress, concluding that the defendant had abandoned his bag and relinquished any reasonable expectation of privacy. Defendant pled guilty, reserving his right to appeal the denial of his motion to suppress. Defendant gave notice of appeal from the order denying his motion to suppress, but he failed to give proper notice of appeal from the judgment entered on his guilty plea. So the first issue that the Court of Appeals has to address is whether that notice of appeal was defective. Defendant conceded that it was, and whether the Court of Appeals would allow review by certiorari. And after a little bit of discussion about that, the Court of Appeals decides to allow review by certiorari. The defendant first challenges a number of the findings of fact in the trial court's order. He challenged the finding that the defendant's bag was in the chair out of view of the sales associate, that the defendant was in the loss prevention office for about 30 minutes, that the defendant left his bag unattended for about 40 minutes. The Court of Appeals reviews the evidence presented at the motion to suppress and finds all of those findings supported by the evidence presented at the hearing. The defendant also challenged the trial court's conclusion that he intended to abandon his bag and relinquished any reasonable expectation of privacy. The rule is that the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. A person has a reasonable expectation of privacy when, one, the person exhibits a subjective expectation of privacy, and two, that society is willing to recognize as reasonable. As the Court of Appeals recognized, pointed out here, no single factor is determinative. They looked at some other cases, one case from out of state and one North Carolina case, and the rule that kind of emerges from those cases is this: when the presence of police is lawful and the discard occurs in a public place where the defendant cannot reasonably have any continued expectation of privacy in the discarded property, the property will be deemed abandoned for purposes of search and seizure. Applying that rule to these facts, the Court of Appeals determined that officers were lawfully present in the store to investigate the larceny from a few days prior, and the defendant left his bag in a public area knowing that other customers were in the store. He left the bag alone for about 40 minutes, walked away from it with no apparent intention to return, and based on that, the Court of Appeals concluded that the trial court did not err by concluding defendant relinquished any reasonable expectation of privacy that he had in the bag. The upshot is there was no violation of his rights in the warrantless search of his bag. the denial of his motion to suppress was affirmed.
So, Joe, what do you think are the key factors here in them finding that he did abandon that expectation of privacy? You know, you and I talked about this case previously. If I were shopping at a store and I set my backpack down for a moment, you know, to go get something off a different rack, if I came back and somebody was rifling through my backpack, I would say, what the heck are you doing? Get out of my backpack. So what do you view as the key factor here? Is it the arrival of the law enforcement? Is it the length of time? Is it just all of that together?
Yeah, I think you've got to look at it together. I think this is going to be a totality of the circumstances kind of determination. As the Court of Appeals pointed out, right, there's no single factor that's going to be dispositive in a case like this. But I think the way they articulated that rule as it emerges from prior cases, it does seem to depend on the fact that the abandonment of the property was apparently in response to the police presence, which perhaps is itself an incriminating circumstance, right? Defendant didn't walk away from this kiosk until he saw that these officers had come in. The other thing was, and the Court of Appeals dwelt on this, he walked away from the bag with no apparent intention to return. He was free to move about the store. He went up to the register when the officer asked him to do that and was paying for these other items. It wasn't as if he was kept by the police or by some other force, by some other apparent reason from returning and picking up his bag or saying to the sales associate, hey, I'm going to come back for this or something like that. I mean, this was a defendant who saw the police and then apparently was operating with an intent of leaving this behind, of disclaiming any ownership in it, perhaps because he knew that it contained incriminating material. In that circumstance, the Court of Appeals found no problem in saying that was an abandonment of the property. That was an intentional relinquishment of any reasonable expectation of privacy. There was no problem with the police searching the bag without a warrant.
It does seem like there's a room for an arguing common sense here, right? I mean, that even if I had meant to come back to the bag and then I got interrupted by law enforcement, surely at some point I would say, before we continue this conversation, could I please go retrieve my bag with $65,000 in it just to make sure somebody doesn't pick it up? When you are conspicuously not doing that, that seems to be something of a factor here.
Well, there's also, and there wasn't any consideration of the fact, is it at least arguable that there was consent? The officer first told the defendant that she wanted to search in the bag and then asked if there was anything inside of it. I don't think that argument was presented here, but this was not a situation where as soon as the police picked up the bag, the defendant says, oh, that's mine and you may not look in it and I intended to go back for
right,
it.
Right,
right. I'm not sure how much that played into the Court of Appeals' ultimate conclusion, but the circumstances in this case, they didn't have any problem in saying, right, that the warrantless search was okay.
You know, and that might have been different, Joe. I mean, even if he had abandoned it at the kiosk for some period of time, but then prior to his interaction with law enforcement, did go back and get it. We're not saying that he couldn't, I don't know, reestablish that expectation of privacy, I guess, when he retrieves it or something, but that's not what's happening here. They've found it after this, what seems like a pretty clear attempt to ditch it and leave it behind.
Right. Well, that's all the time we've got for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Lamb. Holding a prior acquittal did not collaterally stop the state from presenting evidence and argument about rape and kidnapping. State v. Ramsey, finding no error in the admission of cell phone video for illustrative purposes. And State v. Pardo, upholding the denial of the defendant's motion to suppress when the evidence showed he abandoned his bag and relinquished any reasonable expectation of privacy. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We are coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, if there's a topic you'd like for us to cover, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Thanks, Joe. Sounds good. Hope it helped.